speaker. It's great to be back.
And I'll be talking about counterterms in n equals 8 supergravity. And this is largely based on work in three different papers with my collaborators, Niklas Beisert, Henrietta Elvang, Ben Friedman, Alejandro Morales, and Stefan Schlieberger, in various different combinations in these three papers. So let me set up the general problem. So let's think about gravity theories in four dimensions and about the divergences that gravity theories might have in four dimensions. If you just do naive power counting, you'll find that as you go to higher and higher loop order in gravity, the divergences naively get worse and worse and worse. And also something that's very specific about gravity that, for example, doesn't help happen in gauge theory in four dimensions is as you go to higher point amplitudes, the naive divergence is as bad as at 4 point. So going to higher point doesn't rescue you from the divergences. No, it doesn't make it worse. It stays exactly as bad as you go to higher point. It's constant. So let's think about gravity versus supergravity in four dimensions. Well, pure gravity, we know, diverges at two loops in four dimensions. And the corresponding counterterm is R cubed. So when I write R cubed, I mean the Riemann some contraction of three Riemann tensors. I haven't specified the particular contraction here. But in general, when I write something like R to the n, I mean contractions of n Riemann tensors in all possible ways. Of course, there's one specific contraction that corresponds to this counterterm. And R cubed is not supersymmetrizable. So that means that there is no supersymmetrization of this counterterm. So that this counterterm cannot occur at two loops in supergravity theories. And indeed, pure supergravity theories are finite at two loops in four dimensions. So if we want to have any hope of a gravity theory in four dimensions that's finite to all loop orders, we should clearly look at the most symmetric such theory. And the most symmetric such theory is n equals 8 supergravity. First of all, it has n equals 8 supersymmetry, and it has a global SU8R symmetry. And actually, this global SU8R symmetry is enhanced to an E77 symmetry. It turns out that this SU8R is the maximal compact subgroup of E77. So this one is a nonlinear symmetry. So it's a spontaneously broken symmetry that's broken down to SU8R. So then there are explicit, very impressive computations done by Byrne, Carrasco, Dixon, Johnson, and Roybon, again in various combinations. And they show that the three-loop four-point amplitude is finite in four dimensions, and also that the four-loop four-point amplitude is finite in four dimensions in n equals 8 supergravity. Now that is, in some sense, a very surprising result. And actually, the general desired pattern, if you're hoping for finiteness to all loop orders, is that the naive power counting fails because out of the numerator of your loop integral, you can pull out at loop level L powers of external Mandelstams. That means you're converting potentially dangerous momentum factors in the numerator of your integral into just kinematics of the external lines that you can pull out that don't contribute to the divergence. And if you can pull out L of these Mandelstams at L loop order, that means that the critical dimension of the divergence would be 4 plus 6 over L at the L loop level. In particular, at in dimension 4, the amplitude would be finite to all loop orders. So this is the pattern that people that hope for finiteness of, for example, of n equals 8 supergravity or even of other theories are hoping to see just to accomplish a finiteness in four dimensions. So this raises a couple of natural questions. The first one is, these guys computed the four-point amplitude. Does that mean that really n equals 8 supergravity is finite at 3 and 4 loop order? In other words, are all endpoint amplitudes really also finite at 3 and 4 loop orders? And the other question is, what can we expect at 5 loops and beyond? Are there any questions about this basic setup?
Yeah. In order to guarantee finiteness, you need supersymmetry.
You at least need a little bit of supersymmetry. That's
how much?
That is a good question that is not known. Well, it's not even known if a maximal supersymmetry of finiteness to all orders. We know that at three loop, any amount of supersymmetry will be sufficient to have finiteness at three loop four point.
Because supersymmetry is broken.
No, so n equals 8 supergravity is definitely not a realistic theory for, it's sort of a toy model in which we try to understand whether we can have in four dimension any type of gravity theory that could be potentially finite. So this is, this n equals 8 supergravity is definitely not a candidate for your, as an explanation for what we see around us, but it's definitely an intriguing question to ask whether there could be any gravity theory in four dimensions of time. Other questions?
So what's the status of lower supersymmetry? Do we know
when we really only know three loop 4-point basically for lower supersymmetry.
It's finite,
yes, for any supersymmetry. So two loop is finite. Three loop is not known for, I think, any other supersymmetry than n equals 8. And it is known in various other dimensions, not for not only four dimensions, but it's only studied for maximal supergravity. Other questions?
One other point. So we know that n equals 8 supergravity cannot produce the standard model of physics.
Yes.
But you've already said that.
Yes.
So you have to go to n equal to 4, which does not. N equal to 4 has a chance of producing the standard.
What is your question? Can you repeat your question that I asked?
It's not completely decided. However, n equal to 4 supergravity is not finite, right?
So that is actually a question that is not known. So I think there are some people that suspect that if n equals 8 supergravity turns out to be finite, that this pattern could at least extend up down to n equals 5 supergravity. I haven't heard any statements about n equals 4. Other questions? So, of course,
we're not the first ones to address these questions, and there are various different methods are used to study this question. For example, Berkowitz pure spinner formalism has been used, which is a string theory method, basically to tackle this question, to ask how many Mandelstams can you manifestly pull out of the loop integram. Then harmonic superspace methods have been used to construct candidate counterterms in superspace for divergences of n equals 8 supergravity. And then there are some non-covariant methods, chiral and real light from superspace, have been used by Kolesch and collaborators to study potential counterterms. And then there's also an automorphism analysis of the precise form of these counterterms that's coming out of string theory. At that, for the moment, I'll have a little bit more to say about this analysis later on. This is done by Green and collaborators. So with that, let me present our approach. So we are actually taking a much more pedestrian approach to this problem, and we see how far we get without, with very basic methods, without putting in too many assumptions. So the main idea is to shift attention actually away from operators to the matrix elements. So that is very similar, actually, to what has been, there has been a lot of progress in studying amplitudes in various theories by shifting the attention away from the Lagrangian and using unitarity-based methods to build up the amplitude recursively. And here also, we are looking at on-shell matrix elements of the operator instead of focusing on the operator itself. So, and a counterterm for an L-loop log divergence in n equals 8 must have matrix elements that have the following properties. First of all, at the leading order, the matrix elements have to be local, so they cannot have any poles in momenta. They have to satisfy the supersymmetric Wada-Takahashi identity, and also they have to satisfy the SU8R symmetry Wada-Takahashi identity. And finally, these matrix elements have to be compatible with E77 symmetry. So you can think of that that's very similar to what you see in a pion-like Lagrangian, as the scalars of n equals 8 supergravity, the 70 scalars correspond to spontaneously broken directions of the E77. It means that the soft scalar limits of any of these matrix elements have to vanish as you take the momenta of any scalar to zero.
And if it's a tree and four loops, we're on-shell finite.
Yes, it's all. We were only looking at on-shell. Yes, absolutely. We're looking at on-shell.
And what does E7 bracket 7
mean? Oh, so E7. So the essential thing you need to know about B77 is that it's, first of all, it's a non-compact symmetry group.
And the compact directions are simply the SU8R symmetry. And the remaining directions are spontaneously broken symmetry. So you can think of like in a pion Lagrangian, and the 70 scalars. So E77 has 133 generators. 63 of those are in the compact SU8R, and the other remaining 70 ones are precisely correspond to these scalars. That's all the information you'll need for this stuff. Other questions? Yes.
You need that for the scalars.
That's your condition for the.
So
this is like a Goldstone boson. Yeah?
Yes, it's a gold. Yes, exactly. So these scalars are the Goldstone bosons of this breaking, and it's not a sufficient condition for E77 invariance, but it's a necessary condition for E77.
And it's the only check you would have for E77.
It's the only check that we have for. That's the only check that we have used. There's actually something called a double soft limit that you can take. And actually, you think, okay, if the single soft limit vanishes, the double soft should also vanish. But it depends actually on how you're taking the order. If you take these two soft, two scalars soft at the same time, you get you actually get a non-trivial result, a non-vanishing result, and that reveals something about the group structure of E77. So that's something that we also did actually for one of the operators, but that's an additional check. Other questions? So let me just give you an overview. You just naively write down, you think, okay, I have a divergence in some graviton amplitude, whatever, some log divergence, what would be the corresponding counterterm? So for example, at three-loop four-point, the candidate would be some contraction of four Riemann tensors. And similarly, at four-point, at four-loop, it would be some d squared r to the four. This is just what I can write down naively. There may be many such contractions. And for each contraction, if it is a valid counterterm, it must be supersymmetrizable. So you should think of this r to the four as some contraction of four Riemann tensors plus dot, 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 containing the full supersymmetrization of this operator. So this is just symbolic for r to the four plus its full supersymmetrization, if it exists. So for each of these operators that I've written down here, there may be a supersymmetrization, or there may be no supersymmetrization, or there may be multiple supersymmetrizations. So this is just what I can write down without even thinking. This is like a big overview of potential counterterms. And let me just, because we'll focus, in the first part of my talk, I'll focus largely on more than 4 points. Let me just give you a quick summary of what is known at 4 points. I'll give you that later on. Let me first start with SUSY and R symmetry constraints. So recall that I'm looking at the matrix elements of these potential counterterms, and now I'm going to see what constraints on these matrix elements do I just get from SUSY and R symmetry at the linearized level. So as I recall earlier on, the matrix elements that I have, they have to be local. Now, locality in four dimensions is particularly easy to study. If you have something that's local and gauge invariant, it must be polynomial in spinner bracket ij, ij. This is the four-dimensional spinner-ellicity formalism. I won't need it a lot throughout the talk, a little bit. So if you're not familiar with it, it's not a big problem. So the basic idea is that when you have an on-shell null momenta in four dimensions, you can decompose it as an angle and a square bracket. These are basically Weyl spinners as a product of two Weyl spinners. And the inner product of these Weyl spinners are these angle and square brackets. By dimensional analysis, if I have a counterterm of the form d to the 2k r to the n, the spinner bracket must be polynomial of degree 2n plus 2k. Note that here k is related to the number of derivatives. So it must have also, yes?
In the counterterms, you are forcing them to be unshelled, am I right? By saying that P.
Oh yes, sorry. These are only on-shell matrix elements.
So these are on-shell.
Only matrix.
So okay. Therefore, you cannot. Is this enough to get the full information of the counterterms? Don't you need off-shell information as well?
At the leading order, all I can really say is, I mean, if I want to write down the operator, it may have some off-shell information. For example, I can change it through the equations of motion or something. But at leading order, the matrix element is going to be unaffected by such a change. So. At leading order, each consistent on-shell matrix element must correspond to some operator. And if two operators have the exact same matrix elements at leading order, they must be related by some rewriting, for example, through the equation of motion. which then may change the higher orders.
But that's on shell again.
That is on shell, yes. So
how do you do loop calculations? You have to integrate all the internal momentum for propagators.
Yes.
Listen, you have to be off shell.
No, so exactly, that is correct. We are not doing the loop computation here. All we are saying is that there's a log divergence. We know that to a log divergence in quantum field theory, there must be a corresponding local operator that satisfies all the symmetries of the field. So we know that there's a counterterm that if there is a log divergence. We're not doing the loop computation. All we're saying is if there were a log divergence, we know there would have to be such an operator. And now we're studying, does an operator with such symmetries even exist or not? So this is just the existence of potential counterterms. We're not doing the loop computation. That means if we find an operator that satisfies all consistency conditions, we cannot say whether there's a divergence or not. All we can say is that we cannot rule out that divergence.
That's not a proof that
you have
normalized the loop. You can get off the shell.
No, if there were no counterterms with the available symmetries, if there were no counterterms available with that satisfy all symmetries, then that will show you that there cannot be a log divergence in that theory. Now, that's not exactly what we'll find, but if that had been the conclusion, that would be there.
This is what's called a necessary but not sufficient proof.
I mean, the thing is that what you will show is, let's say, it doesn't exist on shell. But is that enough to tell you that it may not, it may exist?
Possibly. Well, if there is a divergence in an on-shell matrix element in the actual loop computation, then that must correspond to some operator that has all the symmetries and whose on-shell matrix element precisely gives you this divergence. And if there is no such operator, then this log divergence.
Whether the scattering matrix is a function.
No, it's not only that. I mean, if the operator exists, it may vanish on shell.
If it vanishes on shell, then it cannot be a counterterm because it would correspond to vanishing.
Not necessarily. I mean, what if it occurs in loops and so on? But it's not on shell.
It's a loop computation of an on shell entity. So it's true that the loop moments are off shell, and then you're doing an off shell computation. But the final amplitude, no matter what off shell prescription you use to do your loop computation, or even if you do it through unitarity, then the final result is going to be an on shell amplitude. Is going to be an on shell amplitude that corresponds to some log divergence.
For the amplitude, yes, but I mean, what if this thing occurs with legs, inside the loop, such that the legs are off shell?
Yeah.
On the outside of your amplitude, you are going to have everything on shell.
But that is not the question I'm asking. I'm asking
whether the operator exists.
He's postponing that question and asking it about the external legs. If the answer to that question was yes, then there would be an amplitude with external legs, which would have a probability.
When it is no, when it does vanish, is my question.
That operator that you're talking about may be interesting, but it's not interesting for the study of log divergences that can function as counterterms. Because it's a log divergence.
I don't want to take the time, but I'm not sure I found it.
Okay, we can discuss it later.
Okay.
So, and as I told you before, they must satisfy the corresponding SUSY and our symmetry board identities, the on-shell matrix. So let's just do this warm-up first, a well-known and well-understood example, which is R to the 4th. Let's consider the matrix elements minus, minus, plus, plus. So that's two negative helicity gravitons and two positive helicity gravitons of contraction R to the 4th. And it's clear just from these two requirements that they must be local. I haven't I forgot to explain little group scaling. Little group scaling means that if a certain line I has helicity HI, then if I scale the angle brackets and square brackets in this way, the on-shell matrix element must satisfy this homogeneity under this scaling. And it turns out that little group scaling and dimensional analysis uniquely fix this matrix element of R to the 4. That's just to see as a little warm-up how you can use these to constrain matrix elements. And if you are at the MHV level, MHV level means the level in which you have two minus helicity gravitons and the rest are positive helicity gravitons, and all other matrix elements that are related to this one by supersymmetry. It means that at the MHV level, we have this. We are in this fortunate situation that one matrix element fixes all others through supersymmetry. So that means once I specify one, I specified all others. So these are the basic methods that we'll be using. Let me show you this in a concrete example. So at the four-point level, as I want to tell you about higher point, let me just mention that it is well known that there are linearized supersymmetrizations of r to the 4, d to the 4, r to the 4, d to the 6, r to the 4, d to the 8, r to the 4, and so on and so forth. They turned out to be unique. There's only one of these guys at linearized level. They are unique. And but at nine loops, I think that it starts an ambiguity, and there are two different d to the 12, r to the 4. But that won't play much of a role for us. So let's focus as an example on the most simple. The most simple example is r to the 4. Let's look at this potential counterterm. And the five-point superamplitude for r to the fifth, well, let's start with its project out. Let's look at the pure graviton matrix element minus, minus, plus, plus, plus. That one is, again, unique by little group scaling and dimensional analysis and is simply given by this one, by this expression. Oh, the four-point I'll talk about later on, but I'm just saying that these results have been well-known for... So you're asking in particular about the four-loop one, is that...?
Supersymmetric
Cam's term at
three loops to four points.
And that is correct. As long as you only look at the suing and
R. So it's a surprise from this point of view of the amplitude is finite.
Yes, we'll get back to that later on to see that. But as long as you only impose suing and R symmetry, this one is perfectly consistent.
And your MHV counting from just before did what? That was just.
I haven't given you a rigorous argument why that exists. It was more like a warm-up to see how one can construct matrix elements. I'll actually say more about that in a second. Let me say something about R to the fifth, and then I'll also address your R to the fourth question. So the SUSY board identities, actually, if I start with this one, just by using SUSY board identities, I can determine this permuted matrix elements, matrix element plus, 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 minus, minus. And it takes this particular form. Now, this looks non-local. It looks non-local because it seems when momenta 1 and 2 become collinear, then you have a divergence here, so you have a pole, actually even a fourth-order pole here. But just because something looks non-local in spin-up brackets doesn't mean it is actually non-local, because there may be a rewriting using Skouten identities and momentum conservation, which if I rewrite the numerator in a smart way, maybe I can cancel all this non-locality. It's not at all clear just from something looking non-local that it is non-local.
Unitarity. Satisfy unitarity at all orders.
Here we're looking at the matrix elements of the counterterm. It's basically once you're given the counterterm, it's just a tree level question. You're just looking at the matrix element of an operator, the leading ones. And you're not looking at loop level matrix elements of this operator. We're just looking at its leading matrix elements, which must be local. There are no poles. There's no unitarity to consider that. There are no extra poles because it's there are poles. For example, if I would compute the 6-point matrix element of an R to the fifth. There would be poles because I could have a 5-point vertex from R to the fifth combined with a 3-point vertex from the Lagrangian. But in this case, as it's the leading matrix element of R to the fifth, it must be local. So this looks non-local, but is it really? So we're trying to prove that it is actually non-local to rule out R to the fifth as a counterterm. And we're actually head-checking a method from recursion relations, which is we're basically looking, we are deforming the external momenta in a way to find that this matrix element blows up. And the way we're doing is we're using what is called a holomorphic three-line shift that was invented by Riesager. We're doing this on this matrix element. And that shift shifts the angle brackets in this way, where x is some reference spinner, and cyclically in 1, 2, and 3. So I've only written down the shift for angle bracket 1, but 2 and 3 are just cyclically defined like that. The shift has the property that it satisfies momentum conservation and that all lines stay on shell. So it's still an on-shell matrix element after this deformation. And it's easy to see that under such a deformation, the numerator simply stays invariant. And the denominator, at a certain value of this deformation parameter z, develops a fourth-order pole.
So that is a way of proving that this guy actually does have a pole, and there's no way of rearranging the numerator to entirely cancel this pole. So we conclude that R to the fifth is not consistent with supersymmetry, simply because we started with this input, which was the unique thing of this matrix element, what it had to be. Susie gave us a different matrix element, and that one is non-local, but the leading matrix element would of R to the fifth would have to be local. So we conclude that R to the fifth cannot, there's no n equals 8 supersymmetrization of this R to the fifth that is non-vanishing on shell, and therefore there, it cannot occur as a counterterm in n equals 8.
So
good, that's a good point. So we are at 5 points. That means everything is either MHV or anti-MHV. So you could do the same analysis for the anti-MHV sector, and you'd do the conjugate shift. You'll find the exact same conclusion, and that's why this this MHV argument is sufficient to rule out for outlook.
Was a fourth, right? So why did you, can you remind again, why did you cross it?
Oh, yeah, I didn't tell you why I crossed it. Well.
And that is true, but the reason why there is no D square. Oh, there is a box. Well, okay. In the end, I'll come back to that later, but the easy way of saying, the simple way of saying is the why there's no D squared after the 4 is because S plus T plus U is 0 on shell. And the reason is that the matrix element that you construct would have must have a factor of S plus T plus U. That's the only thing that is symmetric in the three Mandelstams. And it ha- and, but I'll come back to that later on. But that's the short answer to why there's no D squared R to the 4. But for example, there's a D to the 4 R to the 4 because, you, because this guy does not vanish. And that's just, I mean,
so,
that's
so isn't this the kind of thing that I was trying to understand? So, namely, there is a counterterm which will vanish when it is unshell. I mean,
yeah.
If you had not put the unshell condition, then
yes, but that would not cannot correspond to a divergence of the unshell amplitude.
No, what if it occurs as a if you need it as a counterterm inside loops? It's not unshell. The legs are
but
not unshell.
No, but when there's going to be one amplitude, one on-shell amplitude, it's going to be the first divergence in n equals 8 supergraph. The very first one that diverges. If it diverges, there must be one. You agree with that, right? And that logarithmic divergence would have to correspond to an operator, the corresponding counterterm. And that counterterm has to satisfy all possible symmetries. Okay. Maybe we should discuss it afterwards. Are there other questions?
The reason gravity in four dimensions is not normalizable is because the G is inverse mass square dimension. The reason QBD is normalizable is because E is dimensional. So what you're relying on is the inside loop calculation, and you get the supersymmetry cancels out any possible divergence in the loop calculation.
Well, supersymmetry definitely.
You need a cancellation.
Yeah, but the cancellation, we don't need to look at the cancellation within the loop diagram. We can just look at the result, and we now can have consistency condition on the result of the on-shot amplitude. And that supersymmetry also helps us. That will, of course, translate into a cancellation in the actual computation. But I don't need to specify whether you're doing the computation using some light cone method or whether you're doing dimensional regularization or whatever you do. But we're just looking at the results for the on-shot amplitude and see if that's. Maybe we should discuss it afterwards.
Yeah.
So that rules out R to the fifth as a potential counterterm. So
in particular, we know that if the for loop, as the for loop 4-point amplitude is finite, there's the 5-point for loop amplitude is also going to be finite, the graviton amplitude. So that means that Byrne et al. Have done their job completely at the for loop level, and in graviton amplitudes, there cannot be a divergence at the for loop level. So we can immediately, let me just outline, we can generalize this result for R to the fifth and do it for R to the n. You'll find a very similar expression, except that you can't maybe immediately determine this product of angle brackets. Let me say again that I'm focusing here on the MHV sector, so I'll have two minuses and the rest plus. This won't be sufficient now. No, absolutely. The three-line argument, shift argument, works just the same here. So we get a fourth-order pole here in this 1, 2 to the fourth.
Back in the 80s, there was some suggestion that already at three loops, and now known to be false suggestion, but it would diverge already at three loops.
Yes.
And you're saying that that can't be true. I mean, it doesn't even diverge at four loops now. Is that correct?
Right, but
just
from this analysis, I couldn't rule out the yet the three loop divergence. Is it an observation? But it is an observation by varying from the initial computation. Yes, but no, that is true. But we already know that. So we're looking at the. So I've structured. I mean, I'll talk about after the four later on. So there'll be a different reason to rule this one out. But just. Even as we know from Bern already that this guy is finite, then it's a totally reasonable question to ask, let's say, the 5.4 loop also finite. Because they have ruled out this guy and this guy. They've shown that they don't actually occur, although they're made there.
Here from this analysis, it seems that there could be an operator that could function as a counterterm, but it doesn't occur. So its coefficient is zero, if you want. So then we can look at for loop and continue our analysis.
Supersymmetrizations. This is something that, in principle, Calistel and people could have done in the 80s had they not been stopped at three loops.
Yes. So they have. So they have always. So they've made more inclusive. So they've made certain statements about what they can construct in harmonic superspace. What type of operators they can construct. And so what we are trying to here is going out to see what we can construct. But we're looking at what can we can definitely not be constructed in any formalism, because whatever, however you construct it, its on-shell matrix elements cannot possibly be consistent. So we're doing a ruling out. We're not ruling in things, we're ruling things out.
So in fact, what's very nice is that they get into all sorts of trouble because there's no off-shell any complete superspace. And exactly how much off-shell superspace is allowed to write the Lagrangian circle. And by getting to the on-shell, the matrix elements.
Yeah, we're assuming no supersymmetry at all off-shell. But however you do the computation, you do. Yes. So if you assume that there's a formalism in which all n equals 8 supersymmetries can be realized off shell, you'd be bumped up to high loop level. But no such formalism is known. So we're looking at, we don't assume any off shell formalism, however you want to compute it with. So we're making minimal assumptions here. So as I told you again, the three line argument works here. So, and in fact.
You see, we've sort of. Had too much. We had a fourth order pole. We would have only needed a single order, a single pole down here to rule out this guy because it would be non-local. So, and as you maybe know, when you add derivatives, so any derivative square in this spinner helicity language corresponds to an angle and a square bracket. So in principle, to cancel off this fourth order pole down here, I'd need at least four angle brackets in the numerator to have any chance of possibly canceling off this fourth order pole. In other words, I need at least 8 derivatives. If I have less than 8 derivatives on r to the n, this can never be local. So actually, this argument, you need d to the 8 to soak up the non-locality, immediately implies that there are actually no MHV r to the n, d squared r to the n, d to the 4 r to the n, or d to the 6 r to the n operators for n larger or equal to 5. Now you may wonder, am I restricting to larger or equal to 5? Couldn't I have done the exact same argument for n equals 4? And if you had done this analysis for n equals 4, you'd also would have found like a 1, 2 to the 4th here in the denominator. But then it would have turned out that a smart rearrangement of the numerator would have allowed you to cancel all the 1, 2 to the 4th. And that is directly correlated to the fact that there is no holomorphic two-line shift. You could not have generalized the shift argument to 4-point because you would have needed a two-line shift, and there is no holomorphic two-line shift. That is possible, that satisfies momentum conservation. So that's how this ties in with the 4-point, why it's possible at 4-point, and for larger than or equal to 5, there is these operators are ruled out. So we find that there are, above this diagonal, there are no MHV operators, but as you noticed early on, that there are really only at the 5-point we can say everything is MHV or anti-MHV, so it allows us to rule out all of these guys. While these guys are only ruled out in their MHV sector, they could have a non-vanishing NMHV or N or n squared MHV set. So let's push on. So the let's look at NMHV level. There we apply pretty much the same strategy, except that, I mean, it gets a little bit more technical, but so I'll only give you the outline of what we do. First of all, the first problem is, I told you at MHV level, one amplitude determines all other amplitudes, just by supersymmetry and R symmetry. That is no longer true at the NMHV level. For example, for the NMHV 6-point amplitude, you need 9 different amplitudes that are independent under SUSY and R symmetry. So our strategy is we feed in local basis amplitudes, the most general local basis amplitudes in all these, polynomial and spinner brackets, and then we are projecting out a non-local non-basis amplitude, some different amplitude, and then we are trying to employ a shift argument to prove that that one has to be non-local. So it's a very similar strategy, it just gets a little bit more involved, and it turns out that you can do a very similar three-line shift argument. But now it's less constraining because, in some sense, NMHV is less extreme as far as the distribution of angles and square goes. So there are now more angle brackets in the numerator. And so angle brackets, as I told you, in the numerator invalidate the shift argument. Each one can possibly soak up one power of the pole. So actually what we find is that at the NMHV level, just from the shift argument, R to the n and d squared r to the n operators are only ruled out, not d to the 4 r to the n or d to the 6 r to the n. So you may suspect, or maybe you've just done a stupid shift argument, and we were actually convinced for a long time that we just need to find a smarter argument. But it turns out that this is as good as it gets. You cannot improve this bound, actually. And I'll tell you later on about it. So just from this picture, we now see that there are no NMHV counterterms possible above this diagonal. In particular, that rules out everything at 6 and 7 point, but not at 8 point because there could be an n squared MHV sitting in here. But you immediately see that in particular, there is nothing below the 7 loop level. So there cannot be a divergent graviton amplitude below the 7 loop level at any end point. So there are no potential d to the 2k r to the n counterterms with n larger than 4. And also, let me say, so this is this bound is actually as good as it gets. It's saturated because, for example, you can explicitly construct a d to the 4, r to the 6, a consistent matrix element, a superamplitude that is local and satisfies all SUSY and R symmetry word identities, and the same is true for r to the 8, and similarly here. So this ruling out is as good as it gets. These that exist, they may, for example, they don't have to have unit multiplicity. For example, this one, there are 2 operators of this form, and there are 3 operators of this form. But I'll tell you later on how we get to this multiplicity. But let me say something else. So what about non-graviton amplitudes? You may have suspected, it may be intuitive that the first divergence should occur in a graviton amplitude. After all, gravity is giving us all the trouble, right? But why? I mean, it's really hard to argue rigorously that, or to find an argument why it should occur in a graviton amplitude, except that it's maybe intuitively that's the way it should be. So let's be serious about this and think about all these other operators up here. So this is just schematic. When I write phi r to the 4, I mean any possible operator that contains 5 fields and 8 derivatives. So it doesn't have to have this particular combination, phi r to the 4. It could be built up of fermions plus anything that makes it supersymmetric. So something like that could possibly occur. And so on at higher, and all of these operators defined similarly. So you think of this as a collection of all such operators. So could they occur? Well, we have already done a little bit of work here that helps us to rule out some of these guys, namely these. But then there's still this whole swamp over there. And actually, when we did our work, we were only able to conjecture that this pattern continues, so that there is no n squared MHV above here. So actually, we were able to use the same type of shift argument, and it showed the same non-locality. But the problem with the shift argument was that we needed to assume that this non-basis element that we are projecting out is non-vanishing, because if it were to vanish, you can never show that something that vanishes is a pole. And while that was easy to verify at NMHV level, we weren't able to verify that for higher points. So that's why for the level of our paper, it was only a conjecture that this bound continues beyond NMHV in this way. But that one was actually proven in this precise bound was actually proven in with a very different methods by Drummond, Heslop, and Howe later on last year. And they found exactly that this pattern exists. And that, together with their results, we can be confident that there are no potential counterterms with more than four external legs below the seven loop order. Are there any questions about this?
Is it obvious why there aren't any derivative terms coupled to your scalar field, or is this something you considered and ruled out, or not considered?
Oh, sorry.
So
so these are all possible operators of five fields with eight derivatives. So the derivatives could act on the scalar field. In fact, in n equals 8, they should act on the scalar field because it's a Goldstone boson.
Okay, so
but this is just a symbolic way of, an easy way of
encapsulating
all of these operators. Yes.
The issue of the non-locality. So what you're saying is that you can use differential operators to know what the non-locality. Non-locality means you get differential operators coming in. So
non-locality means you get differential.
Yeah, why are you calling it non-local?
No, he's insisted that it be local.
I wanted it to be local, well, and I found that it's inconsistent.
It's not wrong.
Exactly. That's why it's
differential operator.
Inverse differential operator.
Inverse operator.
Yes, exactly. We don't want that. That cannot occur as a counterterm. So that's why, by finding the non-locality, we're able to rule out these operators. So they're inconsistent.
You can't remove them.
Exactly. That's exactly.
You can't get rid of truncated non-locality. It's a dangerous business.
Can you make a short comment on what the technique was that Drummond and Vidal used?
Oh, yes. So they examined shortening conditions of supersymmetry. Yeah. They used a superspace formalism and looked at shortening conditions. Okay, let's look at E7-7 constraints because we've done everything we can do with SUSY and R symmetry, so let's look at these 7-7 constraints that 3, 5, and 6 look like. So as a warm-up, let's revisit this, and let me make a sort of trivial observation that is still very important for us. And that is the nonlinear supersymmetrization of R to the 4 and these two operators is unique. And why is that? Imagine that for some reason there were two different supersymmetrizations of R to the 4 that would suddenly start to differ. They would be the same up to a certain number of points, but suddenly they would start to differ, let's say, at 6-point level. If they differ at 6-point level, then the difference between those two supersymmetrizations would have to be an operator that that starts at the 6-point level. So it's matrix elements, so this would be a 6-point operator that satisfied SUSY and R symmetry, so it would be exactly of this type that we ruled out. So this ruling out these higher order guys in particular means that R to the 4, its nonlinear completion has to be unique. And that's going to play a role for us later on. And the same is true for D to the 4, R to the 4, D to the 6, R to the 4, but not for D to the 8, R to the 4. Okay. So let's remind ourselves of E7-7. So E7-7 is spontaneously broken to SU8R, and the 70 scalars of N equals 8 are the Goldstone bosons. And actually, the continuous E7-7 symmetry is non-anomalous at the loop level, which was proven by a very elaborate paper by Bossert, Hillman, and Nicolai last year. So let's use it. So if we would think, so these are the operators that are left over, right? R to the 4 up to D to the 6, R to the 4. So let's look at these vanishing soft scalar limits. Well, the first thing you try is the leading matrix element, the 4-point matrix element. But it turns out, so these are the 4-point matrix elements of R to the 4 up to D to the 6, R to the 4. They're just given by this. For example, R to the 4 is STU times the 4-point supergravity tree level amplitude. So you see this is local because all possible poles here are canceled. So this is just one way of writing it. But in particular, because we know that the soft scalar limit of the tree amplitude in N equals 8 supergravity definitely satisfies all the relevant soft scalar limits, they vanish. When you multiply it by STU, that vanishing stays vanishing. So in particular, we can't gain anything at the 4-point level and can't rule out R to the 4, D to any of these operators just by E7-7 at the leading order. So we need to go higher. So what we really want to go to find anything non-trivial is we have to go to the 6-point NMHV level.
So let's do that for R to the 4, and what I'm telling you about now is in collaboration with Henrietta Elvang. So if you were brutal and wanted to compute this desired matrix elements, two conjugate scalars and the rest gravitons of R to the 4 at the 6-point level, you'd have to do a Feynman diagram computation that schematically takes this form. So you have R to the 4, a 4-point vertex with a supergravity vertices, and so on and so forth. A 5-point R to the 4 insertion and a local 6-point R to the 4 insertion that's in the completion of R to the 4. But the problem is we don't know this nonlinear completion of R to the 4. It is not known. So and therefore, we cannot simply write this down. We cannot do this Feynman diagram computation because we don't know the interactions. So how do we get around this? So this is a very hard problem. So we actually use a trick. We use the closed string tree amplitude. Now let me just recall some things for you from closed string theory. So basically we're looking at closed string tree amplitudes that are compactified down to 4 dimensions toroidally. So the leading order effective action is simply the supergravity action, and then there are alpha prime corrections. And in particular, there's an operator that sort of takes this schematic for e to the minus 6 phi r to the 4 plus its supersymmetrization. So how does this help us? And at first, it seems it doesn't help us because the string theory tree amplitude, the closed string theory tree amplitude has very different symmetries from n equals 8 supergravity. In particular, instead of having E77 that's spontaneously broken down to SU8R, we have O6,6 that's spontaneously broken down to SU4 times SU4. And this is this breaking is through the explicit alpha prime corrections. So all we know is that e to the minus 6 r to the 4 coincides with r to the 4 at the 4-point level, but it will not coincide for n larger than 4. So, in fact, if you compute from the closed string tree, you compute these matrix elements here with a scalar and its conjugate, you'll find that it depends on what scalar you pick, what the exact soft limits are. So it turns out there's 3 different types of scalars, and depending on which one you pick, the soft limits are either this, this, or actually vanish. Now, how do we understand this vanishing? It's actually trivial to understand that one. It simply follows because there are still 36 Goldstone bosons. So 36 of the 70 scalars are still Goldstone bosons. So and that is consistent with this result that these guys here vanish. But how does that help us? I mean, which one do you pick if you want to say this is really the soft limit also of R to the 4, the one, the operator that we're looking for? But before I go into that, let me just, how do you even get to this result in the first place? It's actually a little bit of an elaborate procedure. You use the 6-point open string tree amplitudes that were used by Stieberger, that were computed by Stieberger. Then we plug them into KLT to obtain the corresponding closed string tree amplitudes. But those actually give you the wrong closed string tree amplitudes. If you just plug them through KLT, you'll not get precisely this one. So then you have to use Susie Ward identities to relate them to each other, and you'll actually, after you use the solution to the Susie Ward identity that you worked out, you can uniquely determine all of these guys, and you actually get an extra, the order of 30 different consistency conditions because you have more Stieberger amplitudes than you actually need. So this is the general strategy. But how does this tree-level SU8 violating operator of string theory have anything to do with this three-loop SU8 invariant potential counterterm that we're interested in? So let me tell you what the solution is. It's actually quite simple. We decompose the matrix elements of this e to the minus 6 phi r to the 4 according to irreducible representations of SU8. And then we simply take the singlet. And the singlet the singlet must correspond to the matrix elements of some supersymmetric operator that is also SU8 invariant because it's the SU8 singlet. And so the only input that we're using here is that closed string theory is consistent at tree level, that it gives supersymmetric amplitudes at tree level, which I think is a safe bet. And then we use the uniqueness of R to the 4. We know that the singlet must be exactly this one operator that we're looking for. And how do we get the singlet? Well, it's just the easiest way is to do an SU8 averaging procedure, which just gives you the scalar graviton matrix element of R to the 4 is actually a particular linear combination of these stringy scalar matrix elements that I showed you on the previous slide, and they're just combinatorial factors corresponding to these different types of scales. And the conclusion is after you do this and you take the soft limit of this average, you find this soft limit for r to the 4. And the only thing that's really important about this is that it's non-vanishing. So the fact that it's non-vanishing implies that r to the 4 violates the continuous E77 symmetry, and then this explains, in retrospect, is a way of explaining the three-loop finiteness of n equals 8 supergraph. Other questions about this?
So let me make a brief connection
to this automorphism analysis of Green et al., which is a very different approach. So they made an ansatz for a potential counterterm or for some operator, which is f, the function of the moduli, that means of the scalar, times r to the 4 in string theory. And then they used supersymmetry to constrain this operator, and they started in 10 dimensions. And then they worked their way down in a very complicated procedure down to 4 dimensions through some consistency conditions. And they found that these consistency conditions restrict f, the stringy f r to the 4 of phi here, to well, if it's SU8 invariant, f, actually it restricts it to satisfy a certain Laplace equation on the coset E77 model SU8. So it has to have this eigenvalue under this Laplace operator, which is a complicated thing, but at leading order, it's just this very simple Laplace operator. Why do we look at this? Well, we just, from the soft limits, we can actually reconstruct our f of phi that corresponds to this operator that we found, just to leading order. And that allows us to leading order to check this Laplace equation. And it actually comes out directly on the nose, this f of r of R4 of phi precisely satisfies this Laplace equation. So this is a valuable consistency check. You can either see it as a valuable consistency check on our analysis or on their way of working down to 4 dimensions.
R4 was going to be finite. Computing. So that the 4-loop 4-point amplitude is finite, it was computed.
Just hard
work. It was just really hard work. It was computed and was found that there is no difference. So this is not a prediction, this is just like a post-prediction or a reason that there is really no magic in this particular result. Okay, so now that we've done this at the three-loop level, let's go on to the five-loop level. Let's see if we can pull the same trick.
And now this is done, I should say, in a larger collaboration, including Nicholas Beisert, Stefan Stieberger, Alejandro Morales, and Dan Friedman. And for D to the R, for R to the 4, actually things work very much exactly the same way I just outlined. We now look at this higher order correction in the effective Lagrangian effective action of string theory. This corresponds to D to the 4, R to the 4. And we take Stieberger's open string amplitude, send them to KLT, use Susie Ward entities to extract the scalar matrix elements, do SU8 averaging, and use again the uniqueness of D to the 4, R to the 4, and get this soft limit. And again, the only thing that's important is that it's non-vanishing. For us, it was also, So that in particular implies that D to the 4, R to the 4 violates the continuous E77 symmetry, and that predicts the five-loop finiteness of N equals 8 supergravity. And again, the soft scalar limit is precisely consistent with automorphism analysis. In this case, one has to use this Laplace equation from Green et al., and this coefficient precisely satisfies one. And, of course, our analysis was not the first time that someone suspected that the five-loop amplitude is also going to be finite. There were many different approaches to argue this. There are some explicit super. So, for example, one tried to construct explicit superspace operators that are E77 invariant, and one could not write anything down. One didn't find a way of constructing them, so that gives at least some indication that it's hard, that R to the 4 may not be E77 invariant, though it's not a proof. Then pure spinner formalism suggested that one can pull out enough powers of Mandelstam so that the five-loop amplitude should be finite. And then there were also some light cone superspace methods by Kalosh. There's like a certain off-shell formulation of n equals 8 that suggested that enough supersymmetries are realized off-shell to make this amplitude finite. Other questions? Okay. So now that we are there, next step would be to go there, right? So why shouldn't the same thing work again? Turns out we're a little bit out of luck. We need to do some actual work for D to the 6, R to the 4. Because if we do the same procedure, the averaging, the KLT, Susie Ward, and his averaging, we get for this average SU8 averaging of each of the minus 12 phi d to the 6 r to the 4, the stringy operator, this non-vanishing result. But that does not imply that d to the 6 r to the 4 has a non-vanishing soft limit. Why not? And the reason is simply that at order alpha prime to the 6, there are actually two contributions to the stringy amplitude. There are these guys from d to the 6 r to the 4, but then there could be also two insertions from the other r to the 4 operator. So there's this guy. And actually, there could be even a local. So r to the 4, if you want to complete it to all orders, it'll also have an alpha prime to the 6 correction that'll give a local contribution to this particular amplitude. And the reason is simply that, well, so you know that when you have a Lagrangian, you're trying to show that it's supersymmetric, the Suzy variation is only going to close up to the equations of motion. But then when you add this term here to your equations of motion, the equations of motion are going to receive correction as alpha prime to the third. So then you have to re-supersymmetrize this guy, and it'll give contributions to alpha prime to the six. So that's one way of looking at it. So they are local. In particular, these guys are not so dangerous for the soft limit, but these guys are really dangerous for soft limit. So this is problematic. So how do we get rid of this thing? So we want to compute this independent contribution of d to the 6 r to the 4. We need to sort of first subtract this dependent one. And let me just outline the procedure to get this r to the 4 square contribution. So it, as I told you, it has pole terms and it has a local term. The pole term is actually easy to compute from Feynman diagrams. And the reason is because it's two leading order r to the 4 vertices. So it's not the nonlinear completion that we need of r to the 4, but only the linear one. That's why we can actually compute these pole terms. But then we should be able to, we should also allow for something local to be added. So we use Feynman diagrams to compute the pole terms, but then we fix the local terms. We add arbitrary local terms and fix them by imposing that the resulting matrix element satisfies supersymmetry and consistency conditions like Bose symmetry among identical particles. And it turns out that these conditions uniquely fix this local addition. And once you have this local addition, you can take the single soft scalar limit of this guy. You find that it's indeed non-vanishing here. And recall that this was the stringy average thing that we found. So now we need to subtract the appropriate linear combination of this dependent contribution to really get the independent d to the 6 r to the 4 operator. It turns out to be this. And again, it's non-vanishing. So d to the 6 r to the 4 is also ruled out as a counter term in n equals 8 supergravity. And let me also say that these results are consistent with automorphism analysis. The Laplace equation in this case for d to the 6 r to the 4 is more involved that they write down. It contains a source term. And that source term you can really understand as coming from the r to the 4 term in the effective action, basically from this contribution. And adjusting the coefficient of the source term to precisely the right value, so that means 0 for n equals 8 supergravity, and to whatever it is, theta 3, 1 half theta 3 in closed string theory, we can both reproduce this coefficient and this coefficient from the Laplace equation. So both the results are precisely consistent with their analysis. Other questions about this?
If you just used E-Sepman symmetry and not bothered using supersymmetry, would you have been able to rule out all those other stuff that you ruled out before using supersymmetry? Or do you know?
So that's a good question. I'm not sure. So I mean, sort of, we used supersymmetry when checking E77. We used it in a very essential way by using the Ward identities to find even these scalar amplitudes. So I'm not entirely sure whether that would have worked or would have not worked. One thing to definitely point out is that for example, in string theory, there is an operator phi r to the 4, while R, Suzy and R symmetry ruled it out for n equals 8. So SU8R is absolutely essential to rule out this whole garbage to the right that you saw on the earlier slide. So for example, even before using E77, this guy totally relies on SU8R to be ruled out. So stringy, all of these guys here exist in string theory that has the same amount of supersymmetry, but doesn't have the R symmetry. And doesn't have E77. So SU8 and so E77 in particular, it's subspace S, it's, so if you just do SUSY and no E77 in particular, no SU8R, you would not have been able to rule out any of these other variables. Other questions? Okay. So there are no potential counterterms below the 7-loop level. So let me make a very brief comment about SUSY and E77 constraints at 7 loops and beyond. So this is the picture that you saw before, but now I'm starting at 7 loops because we've ruled out everything above. And there are certain here I've now also included the multiplicities of these different operators. And you see that this bound is precisely saturated. Now we have two different ways of computing these multiplicities. Because of lunch, let me not go into the details of these two different methods. But where they are applicable, so for the operators where we were able to apply both, they were perfectly consistent and yielded exactly the same results. And let me particular point out, let's focus on 7-loop level. You see there is 1 at 4-point, 2 at 6-point, 3 at 8-point, and so on. So I mean, this doesn't increase linearly forever, but I'm saying it becomes more and more as you go to higher and higher even-point even-point operators at the 7-loop level. So in particular, you notice here there's a phi squared r to the 8. So these are these sort of esoteric operators earlier on that don't have any pure graviton matrix elements. They actually do exist, but they just don't exist below the 7-loop order. So, and actually the multiplicity goes up and up and up as you go to a higher point. It becomes increasing and increasing. So that, at first sight, that's bad news for Bernardal, because if they find that the 4.7-loop amplitude is finite, it doesn't mean that the 7-loop order of n equals 8 is completely finite. In fact, it seems like they'd have to do compute an infinite number of amplitudes to prove it's finite. But something else actually helps us here, and that is that all of these operators here violate E77 already at leading order. So this is much easier to analyze than what we had to go through this whole pain of showing E77 non-compatibility for r to the 4 and so on and so forth, because we had to go to a non-leading matrix element. But here already at leading order, all of these operators violate E77. They have non-vanishing soft scalar limits. So one can show this, that they're already violated in leading order. So in particular, p to the 8 r to the 4 is, from this analysis, the only potential 7-loop counterterm. So all of these guys here are ruled out by E77. So really, at 7-loop, one can also focus at the 4-point function. Now, you may say, OK, why don't you also rule out this guy at the 7-loop? Why don't you do this whole stringy computation again? And we did. We did the whole stringy computation again and found for the SU8 averaged stringy operator this soft limit here. And you see, this time we don't have any trouble from contamination from lower order terms. So it seems like I should be able to identify this with a matrix element of d to the 8 r to the 4. But that's not true, because d to the 8 r to the 4 doesn't have a unique supersymmetrization. The nonlinear completion is not unique, because there were all these operators that I could have added to them that are perfectly consistent with SU8 and SUSY. So in particular, at the 6-point level, I could have added d to the 4 r to the 6, and there were two of these guys. And I told you they were not compatible with E77, so they have non-vanishing soft limits. So it turns out that these soft limits of d to the 4 r to the 6 take precisely this form. So C1 and C2 are simply the two coefficients of d to the 4 r to the 6, these two different operators, and they span this soft limit space. And now it's easy to see, you can simply add an appropriate linear combination of d to the 4 r to the 6 to make this soft limit vanishing. So there is a supersymmetrization of d to the 8 r to the 4, though it is not this one that comes out of string theory, that is perfectly consistent with E77 at the 6-point level. So, yes. The double soft limits also worked out. We did study the double soft limits also. But, of course, that's still not a proof. I mean, it's a consistency check, but we haven't done the 8-point computation. So, but it's at least consistent with continuous E77 up to 6 points. And the next relevant test would be to 8 points. So Nicholas Beisert has convinced me that there's probably an argument that one can make that also at the 8-point level, you can precisely add a linear combination of R to the 8 that makes the soft limit vanish, and so on for the higher point one. But that's not something that's in the literature or perfectly worked out, but there seems to be a strong
at least a strong indication that D to the 8 R to the 4 is in fact consistent with E7, 7 to all orders. Now, how does this connect with earlier constructions, much, much earlier constructions of E7, 7 invariants at the 7 loop level? And it turns out that people wrote down a formal expression for a counter term that is E7, 7 invariant at the 7 loop level, but people didn't know whether it's a superspace expression, whether it actually vanishes after you do the integration. And it turns out that this particular thing that you write down actually vanishes for low supersymmetry for n equals 1 and n equals 2, but it's not known whether it vanishes for n equals 8 or not. And that at least seems to be an indication that it probably does not vanish. It's a non-vanishing counterterm that may occur in the 7-loop 4-point amplitude. So with that, let me summarize. So there are no candidate counterterms for n equals 8 supergravity below the 7-loop level. There's an infinite tower of 7-loop local SUSY operators, but fortunately they violate E7, 7 at leading order except for this D to the 8, R to the 4. And in particular, if there were 4-point finiteness were established at the 7-loop level, it would imply all n finiteness at this level. And D to the 8, R to the 4 is perfectly consistent with continuous E7, 7 at least up to 6 points. So what are open problems? Well, there's a simpler and a harder one. One is to really work out whether D to the 8, R to the 4 is really consistent with E7, 7 up to all orders. And the other question is, well, if we really want to say finiteness beyond at 7 loops and beyond, we really need a new mechanism. So the question is, what could be? That's really the very hard problem. Is there some new symmetry, some new mechanism that would allow us to argue for finiteness of n equals 8 supergravity, even at 7 loops and beyond? Thank you.
Thanks, Michael, for an excellent comprehensive survey. Can I just press on if you want to get for lunch, but there's time for one quick pressing question.
What effect would breaking of supersymmetry have on this analysis?
Oh, and based on, I mean, once super, well, it depends on how far you, I mean, our analysis was really strictly with n equals 8, so one can try to repeat a similar analysis for less supersymmetry, but I don't, then you'd also have to think, what is the theory? Does it have any of these continued, for example, if you don't have SU8R, so if you don't have the full n equals 8 supersymmetry, you can't have E7, 7. So you would have to find some residual, whatever is left of your continuous symmetry. You'd have to specify the precise theory, look what spontaneous breaking of what symmetry is left over and repeat the analysis. So I can't make any conjecture on that, what the result of that would be.
So if you would try to make a realistic theory based on this, then you just can't say what would happen. Is that fair?
That is fair to say. Well, of course, one can repeat the analysis, but we definitely haven't done that, so I can't make that statement.
Excuse me, this new symmetry that you are saying may be related to this E11 Hess-Moody hyperbolic symmetry?
It may be, I have no idea. So I really have literally no idea what that mechanism would be. So if you have any suggestion, we'd be very thankful.
Well, so some hidden symmetry in supergravity, maximum supergravity, that is the key level.
Okay, so does any of that survive when one can factorize down to 4 dimensions? One would have to ask.
Yes.
Well, this is important. This is a Peter West, if you talk about E11, Tibor Donald, say E10. And they argue with the rest.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But there are some.
But there are bigger symmetries than these.
Okay, that would be actually, I wasn't even aware of that, I'd be very happy to hear more about this. So it would have to be really something big. I think it would be on the same level as what one found in n equals 4 with dual conformal symmetry, or maybe, definitely not quite integrability, but it would have to be probably similarly strong in its implications.
I have to ask for a question. If you look at a gravity in 4 dimensions, you look at the loop intercourse and so on, then the symmetry is diffeomorphism invariance. At every order, you have the symmetry, right?
Well, that's gauge invariance. So we're looking at gauge invariant quantities. So that diffeomorphism.
No, but the question is at each order, the Hodge shell amplitudes are quantum gravity. of the Einstein without actually four dimensions. Satisfy the symmetry, and you have more Takahashi identities that can be all you can show us. Yet, you end up with counter tunnels coming up as you increase in higher orders. And the reason is that Newton's constant is not dimensionless. If you look at power cut and sound television.
Yes, that's how we're
going. Yeah, you still have a big G is still one over a mass mass point.
Absolutely. That's why we need a very strong, need something very strong to get rid of all of these.
Yeah, but the question is,
I think that since we are quite late for lunch, we should probably thank Mike again for an excellent talk, and then there's time for more questions.